Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who are they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 7. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician, podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul Abbott.
Hello, everyone. You sounded quite sort of peremptory there. You were like, you were getting through it like, oh, I've just got to introduce myself and get on with it.
Well, we have.
Oh, okay.
People demand it. No, you know, yeah, just thought we'd get going. I'm all revved up for July 1961 and beyond, which is where we're at, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. Don't forget you can keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please do like, subscribe and review our show if you'd be so kind.
Someone did, Gary.
Oh, did they? I didn't see that.
We got a nice five-star review from jchris15 via Apple Podcasts. Someone in Canada.
Oh, lovely.
And
thank you.
So we really, really appreciate that. It's nice to know people are listening. Nice to know people are listening around the world, and it's nice to know people are enjoying it.
Well,
that's the main thing.
We see statistics. We see our lovely core kind of people on our social medias, and I know it's, you know, no one has to use social media if that's not their thing. But so a little review really kind of brings those numbers that we get. I can see that people are listening and that they tend to listen all the way through, which is mad. So, it's just great if you could get a chance. If every one of you just dropped us a little review, it'd do wonders, you know.
Or just tell a friend. Tell you what, we were doing well in the Norwegian Apple Podcast music charts.
That's great, isn't it? I don't know how.
So hello to all our Norwegian listeners.
Yeah, I mean.
Or listeners in Norway. They might not be Norwegian.
Yeah. Obviously, that's
good, though, isn't it? It's good when you find some. I don't know why it would be seem strange that someone would be listening in Norway, but
I guess it's the language thing. But they speak really good English mostly, don't they?
Oh yeah, much better than I speak Norwegian.
Yeah. So anyone who's listening anywhere, we always appreciate. Yeah. But thanks, I'll have to go read that review. That was literally you hearing it for the first time there. Genuine reaction to hearing we had another review, so thank you very, very much. And also, please consider dropping by the links in the podcast description, which is easy to say, but not so easy to do, because you have to kind of go and look at your phone when you're listening and stuff. But maybe when you finish listening or when it's in your mind, just, what's that link that Gary keeps on telling me about every week? Yeah, go and have a listen.
Maybe if we all click on it, it'll stop going on about
it. Yeah, I mean, I'm leading up to hopefully at some time, probably during the run of this series, to having my next kind of collection of songs out, so I will be banging on about it a lot more then. But at the moment, my last year's collection is out, but my next year's is coming out, well, this year's is coming out soon, so I'll tell you more about that at the time. But talking about time, Paul, should we talk about the Beatles at the time of when the songs in this episode of the podcast were on, and that which is the
indeed.
Name of the segment.
Snappy as ever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this episode is covering approximately July 1961 to sort of the middle to the late part of August 1961.
Yeah.
Okay.
Summer.
So we're basically going through the start of summer. And what we've got here is Ringo turns 21 on the 8th of July 1961.
That's madness, isn't it?
So the Hurricanes have done another sort of holiday camp season, and Ringo's getting a bit restless at this point.
Hmm.
And what he's doing is, he's basically, because he's a big nut for all sort of things American, he's applying for visas to go and work in America and get a job.
Ooh, I didn't know.
So this could have been, again, you know, we always talk about schisms and branching points in the Beatles story. This could have been a branching point in Ringo's life where he just went, oh, I'm done with all this. I'm going to America, and never got in the Beatles in the first place.
Yeah.
Which would be a strange thing to ponder.
Mm.
But as for the rest of the heroes of our story, the Beatles themselves, they're back from Hamburg again, and now they're working all the time.
Right, yeah.
And so they're very often getting £15 for a booking, which is a lot of money in 1961. I mean, it's 280 quid in today's money.
Ooh.
You know, they've not got a record out yet.
Yeah, that's not bad, is it?
They're only local heroes.
There's just four still at this time, isn't there? Four, so...
Yeah, so the backers are four-piece, but obviously what they've got is they've got a few friends and helpers.
Ah, yes, yeah, so they're paying a couple of people out of that 280.
Yeah, they haven't got a formal manager at this point. They've just got lots of people helping them. They're basically, Alan Williams has been kicked out of the picture. You know, he said, I'll blackball you when they cut him off when they were in Hamburg. You won't be able to play anywhere over here. But everyone sort of went, yeah, you can play.
Yeah.
Because they were bringing in huge crowds, you know, they were a really popular draw yeah. in Merseyside. But yeah, they haven't got a manager. Bob Wooler's helping them. Mona Best is still helping. Some of the other promoters that they work with in the area are helping. But they're kind of in charge of themselves. But at this point, someone even starts a fan club for them. Ah. So the official Beatles fan club comes into being in this period.
Right.
As well, which is brilliant. But yeah, they're doing loads of gigs in the Cavern, especially those lunchtime sessions that are very famous for that idea of like, people coming out of offices down for at lunchtime to go and watch them and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I do like the idea that this is sort of McCartney's memories of these and other people's bear it out as well, is that, of course, their amps would fuse all the time because the Cavern was such a sweat pit.
Yeah.
You know, I can't imagine the safety regulations that they would have been breaking
yeah.
or just common sense even.
I don't know if the safety regulations would have existed then to be broken.
Well, they certainly weren't being applied anyway. Yeah. So, you know, the amps would fuse all the time. And the story's always, oh, Paul would jump on the piano and he'd play When I'm 64, which later became da-da-da. But I think it's much more than that. You know, they would grab little acoustic guitars and just do something quick on acoustics. Or they'd just do sketches. They'd just make stuff up.
Right.
They'd sing songs from adverts.
Beatle or
do
improv.
Or do impressions.
I like the idea of them doing an improv scene.
Yeah. I can imagine John at the front going, yes, okay, we need a location. Yeah. A location and a job. Yeah. Whose line is it anyway? Cavern edition.
Mm.
But yeah, I love the idea that you could go and part of the charm of watching them would be that if something went wrong, they'd still just carry on stage doing stuff.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, really, but because they never let that overtake sort of the power of the music, really. They sort of, you know, it works hand in hand. But let's to sort of quickly sum up this period. This is the period where George gets his Gretsch Duo Jet guitar, his sort of very famous early Beatles guitar that he's got in lots of those pictures.
Yeah.
Which is a brilliant story because he bought it secondhand from a guy who bought it in America and brought it back. A chap called Ivan Hayward, this is all in the Mark Lewisohn Tune In book, who lived at 54 Ferndale Road, which is literally, again, about 5 minutes walk from my door. It's two roads along. Was it the next road along? I can't even think now.
Yeah, Ferndale Road. It's the one I have to go, not that one.
Yeah, we've walked up those roads a few times. And so that would be like an identical house to the one I live in, a sort of Liverpool Terrace house, which I just, this is it. I always go on about it. I love the fact that the Beatles story is so suburban.
Yeah.
And it's Liverpool is small enough that this is the sort of place where this can happen and seem significant.
Mm.
Yeah, so George, so this guy wants £90 for it, which is, again, lots and lots of money. George has saved up 70 quid in pound notes.
Right.
And he remembers sort of walking there with like 70 quid in pound notes in his pocket in Liverpool in sort of 1961. It's,
Did you say the guy wanted 90 for it?
Yeah.
But is he just hoping to chance it?
Oh, he gives him an IOU for the extra 20.
Oh, okay.
Which, of course, he never pays. But there
no
you
Georgian
go.
Money.
Yeah.
It's material, isn't it? So, you know.
Yeah. Well, but the point is, they're doing really well as a band on the local circuit. They've potentially got a record coming out that they've made in Germany, but being who they are, they're all a bit sketchy on what it actually is.
Yeah.
But while this sounds all great, they're kind of plateaued again.
Right.
They've hit a point where they sort of like,
where next?
Where next? What now?
Yeah.
And a bored beetle is not a happy beetle, so we'll have to see what happens in the story next time an episode.
I thought you were going to say a board meeting ensued and the Beatles board met to decide, but you said a bored beetle.
Don't worry, we'll get to Beatles board meetings when we're talking about 1969.
Must be much further down the line, isn't it? Yeah, well, this is the thing though, isn't it? I mean, there's a whole thing about the really successful people and brands and everything. They plateau and then they accelerate. They plateau and they accelerate, don't they? They keep on redesigning themselves as the curve is falling.
Yeah, it drives.
Yeah. It's some corporate thing I saw once at one old work training. But it does make sense, you know. It's the people who think, hang on, we can't just let ourselves ride this or drift, that push themselves forwards.
Mm.
And we shall see how next week. But for now, whilst they were there playing along in the cavern and many other places with their little fledgling fan club, what would those fledgling fans have been listening to along with them and, you know, seeing on the telly and listening to on the radio? Probably, perhaps not on the telly.
Buying from probably more shops on the telly than actually on the radio.
Yeah, well, actually,
someone
yeah.
did make a mention on our social media about that there wasn't much pop music programming on the BBC radio, and this was because of this thing called Needle Time where they couldn't play so many records, so they had to have live music or nothing. But there was a load of TV shows that were dedicated pop things that happened over the course of the late 50s, early 60s, etc. And then obviously a little while on from this, Top of the Pops comes along and stuff like that. So there was stuff where you could see and hear people, but there was also record shops where you could go and listen. You know, and I don't know anything about the history of Radio Luxembourg, but that was broadcasting, and I think that played a bit more pop music. I'm sure someone will correct me and tell me, no, not at all. But, you know, there were ways. There was always ways. Otherwise, how would they have found out about this stuff?
Exactly. But it's also interesting to know, because I had to cut this from last week. I don't know if you would know that, Paul, but, you know, talking to Mum about how she would have heard things like Elvis and Cliff, it was from a neighbour who had a gramophone. And they were the person in the street with the gramophone, so people would go and listen to what they were playing. You know, it was like an honorary uncle type of person who lives next door. Kind of, you'd hear the records coming out from there. So it wasn't how the ability to.
Well, yeah, not everyone had a gramophone. Not everyone had a telly.
Yeah,
probably most people had a wireless of some sort. But
yes, yeah,
but not necessarily.
Only probably one between the family. So. Yes, so interesting how these things must have been more valued, I would have thought, for the bits of programming you did get, rather than it just being a constant barrage that you can't select what you want to listen or watch. Anyway, enough of 2024. Let's start with the first song of this week, which is Runaway, Del Shannon. Runaway, Paul.
Insert comedy footstep sound effect here.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. Yes, I won't linger on that silly joke. Runaway, I think you and I are both big fans of this song. Well, I know we are, and have been for a long time. And I think it would be weird if people weren't a fan of Runaway. It's such a seemingly unique little item.
Yeah.
In the charts, and this is where it appears, you know, early in the 60s. So it becomes number one on the 29th of June 1961. Spends 3 weeks at number one, so that's a good slot.
Mm.
Produced by Harry Bulk and Irving Mechanic. That can't be right. Mikachnik. Mikachnik, probably, yes. Yeah. God, that's terrible, isn't it?
I'm sure it's fine.
I'm terrible with my I write these things down and don't say them out loud until I'm on the on the recording session, and suddenly it's like, oh, heck. But the engineer is a guy called Fred Weinberg, who I believe later in McCartney's solo career works with him at some point, but I couldn't pin down exactly what it was.
Okay.
But yeah, I think he worked at a studio where McCartney did some of his recording in his solo career as well. So there's a little Beatles link early on there. This song is written by Del Shannon and Max Crook. Max Crook, very important in this story. And in the UK, it comes out on the London record label. And obviously, it was a hit in America as well. It was a number one.
Yeah.
And it's great because it's one of those ones where if you hear it when you're quite young, it seems, or perhaps just this is just first reactions, whatever age you hear it, it seems like a silly thing.
Yes.
Because of the falsetto vocals in it. But actually, it sticks in your head so much. You hear the falsetto vocals, you hear this astonishing solo.
Yeah.
And but it's such a good song. It is a great song, great performance. And yeah, I mean, let me get the other Beatles connections out of the way here as well. Okay. I mean, the Beatles will have covered this around the time.
Imagine hearing that.
I know. But do you remember back when we were talking about Johnny Tillotson, who did Poetry in Motion?
Yes.
I said that he'd reported that he sang backing vocals on Del Shannon's version of this in 1963.
Right.
And I couldn't work out why, because it seemed like, well, that was happening while they were in London, but his version didn't come out till late. But yeah, so that, we know that one of the Del Shannon Beatles links is Del Shannon was the first person to have a hit with a Lennon-McCartney song in America.
Right.
The first person to have a charting in the top 100 with his cover of From Me to You.
Right. Okay.
I did find a tiny bit more about it. So Del Shannon was definitely in a studio in England on the 1st of May 1963 with Johnny Tillotson. And he does record three songs, because I found an article about this from the time. Although I don't know, what doesn't say what the songs are or why they're doing it. But that's probably the session that Johnny Tillotson was referring to. The Beatles play on the same bill as him in April of 1963, I think. And of course, the big later era rumour was that after Roy Orbison passed away, he was going to be asked to join the Wilburys to take his place as, the old rock and roller with a great voice.
Right, okay.
But that does appear to... And unless someone else can tell me otherwise, it does, from all I could see, it does seem like that was actually just a rumour. The sad thing to say at that point is Del Shannon was born in 1934. He died in 1990 of suicide. So it's not really our place to go into all the background about that and stuff.
I didn't realise it was that late, to be honest.
Yeah.
I thought he died closer to the time of his...
No,
I didn't realise he died later in life. Okay.
So he's born under the name Charles Weedon Westover, 1934. Right. He does his stint in the army, which obviously affects a lot of these American artists at this point. In the mid-50s, he comes out and he joins a band called the Moonlight Ramblers. He eventually becomes the band leader of that, and he changes it to Charlie Johnson's Big Little Show Band, changing his own name.
Mm.
And he gets this keyboard player in called Max Crook.
Right.
Max Crook is the co-writer of this song, and he's a guy who's invented a mad instrument.
Okay, what's he invented?
Or adapted several electronic instruments into something new.
Right.
And one of the things they do in an early version of this band, or in this band, is a version called Little Runaway, which eventually becomes the song Runaway.
Right.
And Big Top Recordings, licensed to London, and there we are.
Ah, so it's a song with a bit of a development cycle behind it. It's not...
Oh, totally. Yeah.
It's been worked and changed and upgraded.
But that keyboard sound is in it from the start. That's very important. That isn't just a stuck-on novelty. This is part of why they record it.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Is it the keyboard part that's playing the solo?
Yeah.
Is that a keyboard part, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I've thrown a googly at me, Paul. I didn't know that. I thought there was some kind of... I was going to ask you, is that some kind of piccolo or something? We'll get onto that in production and whatnot. Should we talk about the music then?
Yes.
Well, as you say, it is definitely a classic, and I've loved this song for a long time, and so it is great to get an opportunity to dissect it a little. I think we had the American Graffiti soundtrack final, and that's where we would have heard this the most, where I got a lot of my...
Yes, you've mentioned
love
that before,
for 50s
haven't you?
And 60s. I know, I think I accidentally called it something else, though. I think I said Lipstick on Your Collar.
No, I don't think you did. I'm pretty sure you said American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. Lipstick on Your Collar's on American Graffiti, I think. Or is it? Mm. I might be getting mixed up. My early years, I've got great musical memories of both the American Graffiti soundtrack and all the songs are on that, and Dennis Potter kind of TV serials with all the 50s music that's on that,
They've all become mixed up in your brain.
It's all become mixed up as just like a kind of a love for the...
Runaway
kind of
is the third track on
American Graffiti.
Side one of the American Graffiti soundtrack
album. I can't even remember if the film's any good, but anyway, that's by the by. The soundtrack's great. But yeah, from that start off with that dramatic A minor intro, and the way that transmutes into the kind of major link or whatever, or the chorus, or whatever, which bit you want to call it, the walking in the rain bit. which then turned into that hook of the falsetto, you know, I wonder line, and yeah, and the runaway motif, and then back to the uber dramatic solo with whatever that instrument is. It's such a neat and flowing composition. It always goes where it had to. Like, there's, it feels natural for it to go where it does. It doesn't even go to a second verse. It's just got the arrangement of this is something brilliant. You'd think, why didn't he do a second verse? But the second verse is the solo verse, and you've got to then go back to that kind of walking in the rain bit from there, because it has such a uplifting chord change to it. And it's, yeah, it has that conciseness of arrangement that, like, I think the early Beatles did. So that's why their songs came on at just over 2 minutes or just under 2 minutes. And you're like...
And it's hook, hook, hook all the way through. Yeah.
And you feel like it's been a 3.5 minute pop song. But you're like, 1 minute 47? How's that? You know, how's that a song that I've got in my head?
This is, what, 2 minutes 20 or something like that?
Yeah, it's not very long, but you feel like this whole thing has played out, and it's because it just unravels itself to you in exactly the right order without outstaying its welcome, yet leaving you kind of very satisfied and kind of not wanting more, but like it's absolutely wedged in your head there. The melody is great. And like exactly as you said, my note is, whereas a youngster you find the falsetto a bit comical, I now find it really just impressive and bold, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's bold. Again, it's where it would have to go. It wouldn't work if you didn't do that. If you said, I wonder, I wonder. It wouldn't work, you know. It has to go up and hit that height, because it all builds, doesn't it? It builds to that runaway bit. I love the energy in the rhythm section, the shuffle and the drive, and how it's backed up by a brass section pushing it along, which, I don't think I'd... Because I've never dissected it before. I didn't realise there's a bit of brass every now and again just pushing the chords.
Let me outline who was playing on it.
Yeah,
so
go for it.
Essentially, it's written... They wrote it originally around this pattern of A minor to G. They're sort of jamming this out, and then Shannon goes off and writes the lyrics at work. He was working as a carpet salesman. He sat on rolls of carpet. You know, probably smelled like carpet warehouses always smell.
Like carpets.
Like lots of carpets. But so when they get into the studio to do this, they have a chap called Al Calleo. Oh, see, I've done it again. I've gone to read a name that I haven't actually said out loud.
It's all right. No one minds.
I'm so upset. What if Al's listening? Al Caiola on guitar. Mo Weschler, see, now I'm saying it like it's German. Mo Weschler on piano.
Right.
And I love the piano part on this. You know, it's
yes,
proper that arpeggio
brilliant.
Piano thing. Max Crook on the Musitron. More on that in a minute. Al Casamenti and Bucky Pizzarelli on guitar as well. And then we have a chap called Milt Hinton on double bass.
That's double bass.
Milt
Hinton
is someone who we have mentioned before. He's a chap who was born in 1910. So, you know, he played with Cab Calloway in Cab Calloway's sort of glory days. But another Beatles connection, he plays on the song Little Woman Love by Macca from Ram.
Oh, yes, I like that one, didn't I?
Yeah, yeah. We have...
That's the kind of boogie movie kind of one.
Yeah.
Boogie movie.
Yeah. Joe Marshall on drums. And then we have the chap who arranged this is a guy called Bill Rammel, who also played the baritone sax. So you get that really nice Barry sax and double bass thing.
That's what I call the brass, but it's actually the lead. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone calls them brass, don't worry about it. But yeah, so that's the people playing on it. So it is quite a small combo. The point is, it's just a nice arrangement, and they've got this insane Musitron on it.
Yeah, so, well, we'll get to that, I think, more in the production then. But as I say, it's a really nippy song, but it doesn't ever run away with itself.
Oh, yes.
I was going to say, all the broken chords and the piano are great. I've never, again, just take it for granted. I just love the song so much, but sit and listen to it. If you just listen to the arpeggios in the piano, it's just a great part. And of course, it has all the more impact when it starts to stop playing the kind of arpeggios and it hits the chords with everything else, you know, the duh, 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 duh. But all around, outside of that, it's just going up and down and up and down, and not just in a standard triad kind of way. It's not just doing it's finding interesting kind of patterns, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear the piano part of this isolated, actually. Whether that's possible, I don't know. The bass is great, walking around the scales, but in a more interesting and kind of jazzy way. It's a, like I say, it's a small group making a big noise and a very good noise. And I've given it 79 for music.
I thought it might be a high scorer.
It's a goodie. It's a goodie.
Yeah.
Let's talk about production then, because I was going to say, I've got a note on here to say to you, what is that? Is that a piccolo flute thing? But go on, tell me about the magnetron.
Magnetron.
The mighty maniacal magnetron.
So this is recorded at a place called Bell Sound in New York on the 2nd of January, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And the recording overall, just before I get, I'm holding out and telling you the details, you see.
Come on.
The recording overall is played in A minor.
Yeah.
It's pitched up to B flat minor. So that gives the falsetto even more sort of impact.
Oh, because it's half a tone higher than he sang it.
Yeah. And it's amazing because he's not double tracked or anything on that. It's, you know, it's clearly just a single voice.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing. So, but yeah, pitched up to give it a bit more energy and make the falsetto even more extreme sounding. But the Musitron,
yeah.
Yeah, is a modified clavier-lin.
Okay.
And everyone in Beatles land will be going, baby, you're a rich man.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because that's the squiggly instrument on that, is the clavier-lin, which is a sort of keyboard synthesizer instrument. I'm not going to talk much about the clavier-lin here because I'll save it for a later number one, which we'll be talking about.
Ooh.
But the Musitron was basically Max Crook took basically a clavier-lin and a load of other equipment like a tape unit to do tape echo, and he built his own thing called the Musitron, which is only about 2.5 octaves of a keyboard, but could play from very, very low notes to very, very high notes, and he had lots of control over the parameter. And it's such a unique sound. But it's not just a weird sound. It's not just a... You don't listen to it and just go, oh, that's a strange sound. It's also a brilliant solo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's much more complex. If you try and sing along with it, actually the little patterns of semitone movements, rather, and inside it are astonishing, really. It's great. So that's a really, really important contribution from Max Crook there on that. That's, and it's a really, really important contribution to the overall picture, I think, of popular music as being a high-profile synth sound up front.
Yes.
On a hit disc.
Yeah, it's a bit of a vanguard for what is to come, then, isn't it?
So there is a stereo mix of this as well. I think we would have both listened to the mono mix, but apparently that's a different take.
Right.
Because that sometimes happens, that the different takes come out as different things. But what I found really interesting from Max Crook was this quote saying that when they were in the studio, they had this system in the studio where they could send live down the phone lines to all these music distributors. They could send the song as it was being recorded.
Right.
So they could basically plug in all these distributing companies and people and say, look, this is what we're recording right now. What do you think? So it says here in the quote, so while we were still mixing Runaway, we bleeped it over the phone lines. Before they even got done with the mix, we had orders for over 5,000 copies.
Wow.
So basically it just went bang right from the off. People knew.
It's crazy. So. I've never known about that before.
No, I've never heard
listening
about that.
Listening in on the session.
On like the mixing session
almost
or
like
whatever.
Bidding for it whilst you're actually doing it.
Yeah.
Man, people worry now about the amount that we put out online when it's not polished to the max and everything. It's like they were listening down a crackly phone line at someone whilst they were recording it, putting in orders. That's the tune I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
That is fascinating. I wonder how much that happened. That whole area is fascinating, and I know more about it now. Okay. Well, I'll go through my production notes. And when I first start, I worried about the production when I first kind of thought, right, production ears now. I thought, oh no, is it one where I love it so much I fill in the gaps, because the piano in the intro has the echo right up, or it's recorded in a reverby room or something, you know, when it first starts. But then as the band comes in, that kind of fades back behind the band, and that's fine, it doesn't matter. And then the broken piano chords come in much clearer over the top. Like, you know what I mean? It starts with him. It might just be the echo pedal down, really. It might be something like that they do in the intro, and then he comes off of it when he... I don't know. But I don't know if there's two pianos in there, actually.
Probably
bashing chords that are echoey and one that doing... But anyway, you have to have a listen. But I'm not sure. But then it didn't matter, because that's just in the intro, and actually it's quite a good effect when it's just brief. But I do love how the sax is in there just sometimes and just pushing along with the bass and marking those chord changes. The kit's a little low, but the snare hits... kind of cut through it all, and you don't really actually notice. And then you've got the kind of reverb there is there, it over everything kind of comes together to make a kind of a almost a subgenre of rock and roll, like dream rock and roll. Do you know what I mean? It's got a dreamy, otherworldly feel to it. There's something about it that I really like. It's
a very American sound.
Yeah, it's a 50s American sound, isn't it? It's nice.
And I think that's very important because so many of the British studios couldn't get that sound right.
No.
It was something to strive for, really. And the irony probably is that the studios were less sophisticated than many of the British ones that were trying to mimic it and not quite get in there with the sort of bass quality and the sort of reverb qualities and stuff.
Yeah, but then I didn't know about that. So I just saying that the solo sound, whatever it was, is great, and it punches through that kind of dream soup as well of the production in
dream soup.
Yeah, to offer the counter melody as well and the solo. I mean, I'm sure there's bits of this that could have been produced better, but I think it has an overall something that you wouldn't want to kind of mess with or sacrifice.
Yeah,
due to its limitations or due to its just what happened in the room or the time it was being made in. I've given it 63 for production.
Hmm.
You know, it's good. Lyrics then. So, lyrics. So there's a lot of walking in this, I realise. Most nearly every line's of lines walking initially, and then it gives away into kind of running.
Is he walking to try and find the runaway?
So as he walks along, he wonders what went wrong with their love, a love that was so strong. And as he still walked on, he thought of the things they'd done together while their hearts were young. Then he's walking in the rain, tears are falling and he feels a pain. And then he wonders why she ran away, and he wonders where she'll stay. I just think he's walking in the rain in general and thinking.
That happens a lot in pop music.
Yeah. But, it's only when you look at it, he's doing a lot of walking, but he doesn't really register listening to it in that way. But I absolutely love the walking in the rain line.
This has just occurred to me, Gary. Sorry for cutting you off there.
It's all right.
Imagine if instead of walk, he said drive.
I'm a driving in the rain.
Would it make that much of a difference? I think it would.
I'm a driving walk.
Or is it that walking and walk walking in the rain sort of work with wonder and
but
why?
Walking in the rain, you're getting wet, aren't you? The point of that is that you are...
It's just a thought, because so much American stuff is about big cars.
Being in cars, yeah, yeah.
You know, and like that Chuck Berry sort of thing. It just suddenly occurred to me there, if you replaced walk with surf.
I think it's a good point, because actually this I've got the word cinematic in my notes, because it makes me see a guy walking down a grey pavement in the rain being sad. Driving in the rain, being inconvenienced by the rain hitting the outside of the car, isn't quite the same, you know. And that would imply going somewhere particular, whereas walking is probably just walking on the way home from work or something, not because they're
just sort of lost in a daze.
Yeah,
sort of. Yeah. I'm looking at it on the page, the amount of W words in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of
really leaps out at you. Walk, what went wrong, was, when, walk, while.
Wonder, why.
Wishing.
It's a very
I hadn't really thought about that until I was looking at it just now, with the W's leap out, so that's...
Until you get to run away, and then you kind of... But then your W and a R aren't particularly different to each other for some people.
There's a W in runaway, though.
Yeah. Ugh. Maybe it's code.
A big W.
But I love the walking in the rain, tears are falling and I feel a pain line. I'm wishing you were here with me to end this misery. That's a great couplet, that is. Pair of couplets. The words are imbued with the passion of the musical performance there, and vice versa. They feed off each other and are evocative and, as I say, even cinematic. I also like how he wonders not just why she ran away, but also where will she stay? Which is a fair question. It doesn't need to make you wonder too much about wonder too much about what else is going on behind the story. It's just enough in itself, I think. I've given it, I don't think it needs a verse two. I don't know if it would have, you know. I think it's right.
No.
It doesn't need it. 65 for lyrics. I've given it. It's like a little slice of misery, which is always nice.
Slice of misery on the side of your dream soup.
So, it gives it 69 overall.
Right.
It's a pretty good showing at this early stage. So we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Next we have Temptation the Everly Brothers. Temptation, Paul.
Well, I can't think of anything for that. What I will say is this is the last UK number one for the Everly Brothers.
Oh, are they bowing out?
Yeah, so essentially what's happening after, a little later in 1961 is they're enlisting in the Marines.
Oh, right.
As their national service.
Okay.
That's October 1961.
And they never really re-established themselves in the UK.
Yeah, but also there's something else going on here as well, so it is worth me just digging a bit more into this, but... facts about this song, it's number one on the week of the 20th of July 1961. Spends 2 weeks at number one, produced by Wesley Rose in name, but in actuality produced in the studios by Bill Porter, or engineered by Bill Porter.
Bill Porter, good old Bill.
Good old Bill. Composed by Nazio Herb Brown and Arthur Freed, because this is a song from 1933.
Is it?
Yes, indeed. Wow. Although you wouldn't ever hear it in this version in 1933.
No. Okay.
It was covered a lot. So famously by Bing Crosby in 1933, it was from a film called Going Hollywood, which sounds like someone from Stoke telling you that they're going to Hollywood.
Going Hollywood.
Just Going Hollywood, Duck.
Going up Hollywood, Duck.
So that's a Bing Crosby and Marion Davies film. It's a popular song, and there's loads of cover versions through the 40s and the 50s, including The Platters, Screaming Jay Hawkins. You even get Cliff doing it as an album track in 1961. But no one does it like in the arrangement that the Everlys do it.
Is it the same kind of chords and stuff?
I mean, fundamentally, because it's a lovely tune.
It slowed down and more kind of... Yeah, without the... Yeah, I can hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in my head.
But before we get stuck into it, I did say that there was more to add here. And seeing as this is the last we're going to hear of the Everlys... So Wesley Rose, the guy who is nominally their producer, A&R man, record label guy.
Yeah.
They fall out with him. So they were using writers from this Acuff Rose publishing house for their material.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good. There was, you know, these were successful songs. But they started to sort of say, well, we want to record other songs that aren't just from this one publisher. Which, funnily enough, the Rose in... Acuff Rose is Wesley Rose.
Yeah.
And so he sort of basically says, no, you record things. And this is because this is what they were doing, A&R managers and things. It's like, well, this is how we make our money, through publishing. That's what we want to do. So this publishing company's got a monopoly on these songs and these songwriters. And the Everlys say, well, we don't want to do these anymore. And they fall out with Wesley Rose at this point because they say, we want to do other stuff. And he says no, and basically bans them from getting the best material. Really. They're writing their own songs, but they were signed to Acuff Rose, so they couldn't even record their own material because their publishing meant that the people they'd fallen out with owned it.
Right.
Oh, which is awful, you know. Yeah. It's I don't know, there's probably a 10-part podcast series in just this weirdness.
Well, I mean, we know with the Beatles, everything.
Publishing is insane, just
crazy.
They tried to do workarounds by using pseudonyms for things, but then they found out that happened. You know, the publishers found that out, brought legal action against them, got the copyright to those songs as well, which essentially leads them to just trying to record, you know, stuff that they can get hold of, these few bits and bobs, trying to start their own record label and things like that. But it just doesn't get anywhere. Oh. And essentially this falling out and the combination of them going off, you know, into the army, into the Marines, means that they never really get back to the heights of this period, even though their careers did last, you know. But they also have all their falling outs between themselves as well and various other typical pop star problems.
Yeah.
But it's horrible to think that they were so sort of bound by this situation of like your own material you couldn't play because you'd fallen out. And if you wanted to go and record a classic song like Temptation, you were going to upset Wesley Rose, who was going to basically shut your career down. And that's what happened. It's at number one, and it basically it's the end of their you know, glory years.
Well, that's rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know what's more rubbish, being made to go and be in an army if you don't want to be, or having your own songs being owned against you, kind of thing.
Mm.
That's, well, I mean, they're just both rubbish, rubbish scenarios. Oh, what a shame for them.
Yeah.
Well, a song to bow out on. Hmm. So we got anything else to say?
Well, just the writers of the song wrote lots of stuff. They were sort of film music producers and film producers.
Yeah.
So like Brown and Freed did Singing in the Rain, which is, you know, just an astonishingly brilliant musical film. So, you know, it's good pedigree, this song.
Yeah.
So
whether it's the
can't
right
argue
thing,
with that.
We, yeah. Okay. Well, that gives me some context, but I didn't write it with that, got my notes with that context, but it doesn't really matter when you're listening to something. So we start with some pretty intense floor tom action and some yeahs.
I reckon that's probably a bit of good Beatles influence on the...
There's a few bits in this of that, but I imagine the yeahs aren't part of the original.
No.
I reckon that's the bits they've added, then all the ding-a-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding kind of answering.
Yeah, there's an intensity to this, isn't there?
It's
definitely
not
there in these other versions.
This is like, yeah, it settles down into what feels like quite a funky groove, but it's a bit soon kind of swamped by the boys, and I'm not sure I like how they sit together on this one. I'm not so sure this is the space for the Everly Brothers for me, you know.
I can't work out if there seems to be extra backing vocalists on it that at some point sort of are layered on top of them, which is a bit weird. It's like you lose the brothers in it.
I like components of it. I like the, talking about the backing, I like the R backing in the chorus, which is very Beatley, kind of, when they're in the chorus kind of midsection, there's just some straightforward kind of blocked kind of R back vocal.
Yeah.
I'm trying to avoid saying R's. It has a riff driven backing that, you know, I should like, but something.
It's almost like
add...
Peter Gunn, isn't it? Some of it.
It's got a lot of, it's driven by kind of guitar and bassy kind of riffs, but something, and I should like that, but something's not quite adding up for me with it. I think it's the Everly Brothers being big and mean. I think it loses their ethereal quality of their voices. I like it, but I don't quite believe it. Them as kind of like more pushy, kind of pushed kind of rock. I think they work better in fun, jaunty, poppy things. But I do like bits and bobs. I like the yeahs being answered by the guitar in the outro. The arrangement seems to come and go without ever settling into anything in a weird way. Yeah, it's a bit kind of... I think this would have worked. This kind of arrangement of this song would have worked better in the hands of a more gritty band, like someone like, or someone with a more of a kind of like, I don't know, someone like the Animals or something. A sound that's
I know what you mean. It's again, it's the Nashville A team essentially. I think playing all this, people like Chet Atkins and Floyd Lightning Chance, Floyd Kramer probably on piano and stuff, Buddy Harmon on drums. Mm. You know, these are well established, but. Yeah, it's a studio band rather than anything else.
Yeah, I don't think if it's their style. I think it's maybe a band with less ability but more raw drive might have delivered it.
But it's got so... The guitars on it are so interesting, I think. You know, it's like, is that a 12-string sound or is it just some doubling up? Is that a baritone guitar in there doing a sort of overdub bit with it, or is it just the bass stepping up in a strange way in the mix? I think that's really interesting to hear. Mm. But... Like you say, perhaps it detracts from the brothers doing their
the
thing.
Point
maybe
the kind of their point of them really.
I quite like it, to be honest.
It has well, it is the makings of a good song with a strong beat and lots of rock riffs. It might be a grower, I've said. So it kind of, I've given it 53 for music. It's not.
I think the interesting thing to think musically, when you strip away the arrangement and the how they've done it, is it's an interesting song because the verses go up. It's upward movement throughout.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. So every verse, every line sort of moves up. And then the B section is moving down. It drops down everything. So it's clearly been written with that deliberate sort of swoop up, drop down, swoop up, drop down thing, which I think is, if you've got the voice for it, which the Everlys do, I think that's what I think makes it hit, really. That's my bit that I think is the hit bit.
Obviously it was a hit, so, but it's also one for me where I've listened to this quite a few times. I still have to listen to it to remember it before we start talking about it and things, because it's not one that's, it's not like a, not, it doesn't, hasn't gone into my head. It's not an earwormy type of one. So onto production then. I think another part, this might be part of my problem, I just think they're laid on really thick over the top of it all.
Yeah, I think it's like very intense.
Their voices like drowning the poor little band with their kind of their luscious vocals. It's not a blend so much. They just kind of, it's more of a smother in this instance, and that makes it all a bit too much Everly Brother in my ear, you know.
Yeah, I don't think this was a big hit in America. It charted, but like down in the 20s, I think.
Oh, okay,
which is interesting.
But when it just drops, and I think that's borne out by the fact that I like it when it drops to just the one voice with the backing vocals, which is the chorusy bit, or whatever it is, in the second weird section. Like, yeah, and then, sorry, no, I like it in the one with the section where it's just one voice with the backing vocals doing the R's, and then when it goes into the second kind of weird section, there's loads of voices joining in and it all goes back in the mix, and it all feels too hot on the mics again. Like, it feels all of it too hot, very pushed. Very, we are doing something more rocky, so it all has to be loud, kind of feel to it. It's just lacking some subtlety in the production.
Are you criticising Bill Porter?
I must be. Sounds like it. Maybe for me, like, less might have been more with this one. So I've given it 38 for production.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't want to contradict or not?
No. I think it's weird. My main thing is it's odd that how they've supported the Everly's voices with backing vocals, especially in the "I'm a Slave" bit where it like swamps them, like it sort of washes over them like a wave.
So let's look at the lyrics then, which is another frustrated young man song. I mean, these pop singers don't have much luck with straightforward love interest, do they?
Oh, yeah, but she was leading him on, it says in
the
lyrics.
Well, I mean, they all are, aren't they? They keep on falling for these teases and heartbreakers.
In 1933,
of course, yes, not even their lyrics, is it? It's just obviously just a story as old as time. But they're pretty okay words. I've not really got much to say about them, to be honest. Temptation is a good word for syllabic kind of dynamics, isn't it? You can do a lot with temptation. You know.
I think they've basically seized on the sort of slave temptation thing and gone really sort of like, well, this is weird. This is actually, they've looked at the lyrics and gone, this is actually a bit weird and moody, this. And that's why they've sort of pushed it up quite raunchy.
They've gone, we're doing rock now. It sounds a little bit like the Mulligan and O'Hare when they do a rock song. And they
like Blaine, Bleeding Eddie.
They curl the lip up a bit and they're like, yeah. Which is a comedy thing, which if you don't know anything about Rivers and Mortimer and you don't live in this country, go and find out who they are and listen to Mulligan and O'Hare. Right. So I've given it 38 for lyrics as well, which gives it 43 altogether. It wasn't my favourite of the Everly Brothers ones. I didn't know it'd be the last one I'd be listening to. It wasn't the least favourite because we had Ebony Eyes, but it wasn't up there with the other two that we'd had at all.
Interesting. I found in Disc Magazine on the 19th of August 1961, they have a little single panel cartoon, because people love it when you describe cartoons in words. It's their chart chuckle thing. This cartoon shows what I presume is supposed to be Friar Tuck bending over a cauldron tasting some soup, whilst behind him is Robin Hood, or one of his merry men, holding his bow and arrow, looking at... And the caption is just temptation.
Right.
So I'll share that.
Okay, you share that.
It's basically saying, would Robin Hood be able to resist pranging Friar Tuck in the bottom with an arrow if the opportunity arose?
Right. I think he probably could.
Yeah, wouldn't do him much favours. He's shooting his own men.
Anyway, let's go on to the next song then. Bye bye, Everly Brothers. It'd be nice. I didn't realise we were saying goodbye to you already, but bye. Yeah. Next then, Well I Ask You, Eden Kane.
Well I ask you, or did you have to beat me down? Did you have to go to town and smash my world in two? Think you're getting away with it, you're gonna pay me somehow. You cruelly wrecked my life, But oh, you want me now.
Well, I ask you, Paul.
Well, I'll tell you, Gary.
Good.
Eden Kane. So, right. This is great. Eden Kane's still with us. He was born in 1940. This gets to number one on the 3rd of August, 1961. Spends 1 week up at the top. I will say straight up front, I think this probably could have been up for longer, really. It was produced by Bunny Lewis, whose full name is Bridges Georges McGibbon Lewis. I'll say that again. Bridges Georges McGibbon Lewis.
Bridges Georges... Same. Bridges Georges McGibbon Lewis.
Yeah.
That was the...
That's the person, Bunny producer. Lewis. Yeah.
Right.
It's a brilliant name. I mean, I like any name that has McGibbon in it because it makes it sound like there's a gibbon there.
Scottish one.
Yeah. Composed by Les Van Dyke, who I think we've mentioned once before, and we will be mentioning again, the writer John Worth, going under the name Les Van Dyke. And I must mention the B-side. I haven't been mentioning the B-sides, actually, to these, but the B-side to this is a song called Before I Lose My Mind, which is a cover version of this really boring country song.
Right.
But it's of note because the song was written by Roy Drusky and it was released by a man called Ferlin Husky.
Drusky and Husky.
Drusky and Husky. What?
What's going on with names at the moment?
Yeah. Isn't it a bit silly, really? Anyway, we've got our first British artist of the week here.
Ah, yes.
And Eden Kane's real name is Richard Sarstead. He was one of the Sarstead brothers with Clive, also known as Robin Sarstead, and Peter Sarstead of Where Do You Go to My Lovely Fame.
Ah, yes.
This is Eden Kane's only number one, but he does have 5 top 10 hits over the next couple of years. Okay. I mean, without doing him down, he's very much in the standard mould of the time of like the solo British singer. It's like they put him out of a, churn him out of a machine, sort of quiffed back hair, handsome chap in a suit, doing a sort of semi-Elvis thing, but not like raunchy.
No.
I've got quite a lot of background on him here, really. Most of it to do with stuff that's got nothing to do with the song, so I'll just drop a few little bits and bobs. But basically, he comes through very early days of sort of playing skiffle bars, being in and around London, things like that. He gets a manager quite early on. The prize for the talent contest that he entered, where he got the manager, was a contract to promote Cadbury's drinking chocolate.
Oh.
So his first recording was sponsored by Cadbury's Chocolate, and the song was called Hot Chocolate Crazy, an advertising jingle used on Radio Luxembourg.
Fair enough. Get you a break, you know.
Yeah, well, because Decca heard it, and they go, you have a record deal.
Yeah.
So he comes up with this stage name, Eden Kane. And he gets this white suit, which he was sort of famous for, this sort of silvery white suit. And his first single, I Ask You, number one. So
I'd say it worked, but a one hit wonder in that he only got to number, well, not a one hit wonder, but a number one.
His only number one, but yeah, he did all right.
But
for
he stayed
while.
Around and made some up, was in the chart. Well, that's good, isn't it?
Beatles Links.
Go on, Beatles Links.
Mainly that he appeared on a few shows with them on telly, like Ready, Steady, Go.
Right.
So like, there's a photo of him I've got here of them on Ready, Steady, Go. It's the Beatles, Helen Shapiro, Dusty Springfield, Eden Kane, and Keith Fordyce. Uh-huh. They moved in each other's orbits a little bit, but there's nothing particularly more than that, I don't think. If anyone knows of any, do tell me.
Ah, well, I'd never heard of him before, or this song. So this is a newie for me altogether. And a bit of chirp. It's got, like you say, that British thing, a little bit of cheekiness, a bit of Auntie Newley about it.
It's a sort of cha-cha-cha, isn't it?
Yeah, instead of you as well. So, well, I ask, yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a, it's like a boogie, isn't it? Like, it's got that slide up on the kind of third note type thing to it, a bit of jaunt to it.
Yeah, but it's rhythmically, it's got the sort of...
Yeah. The piano and the bass and the drums are doing kind of little fills, and I like the musicianship on it. Actually, I like the groove of it. I like how it changes in the second section with just a little subtle chord change, taking it to another place for a chord. You know, when he says, "Don't think you're getting away with it," and then it goes to a different place there because there's a bit of a minor chord or something comes into it. There's not much to this song other than a groove and that kind of that main hooky melody, really, and the riff that plays over it. It's what, three chords, except that it has a key change, so it's what's technically six chords, but it's three chords or something, isn't it? There's not much.
Well, I've not analysed the chords, but there's not too many, though. Yeah. But I think it's interesting enough.
It's nice. It rattles along. It gives it some personality too in the singing, so it keeps you tapping and listening. Yeah, I quite like this. It's all right. I'd be happy to be hearing it on the radio and stuff. It's not earth-shatteringly great, but it's a welcome ditty to cross my ears, and I'd recognise it again and find myself singing it to myself a bit and bobs of it. So I've given it 56 for music.
Yeah, my favourite thing about the whole thing is the bass and the drums work really well together. And like you mentioned them before as well. Yeah. They're worth focusing in on a listen and just hearing how it all comes together in that side of the arrangement.
Yeah, well, this is why I said like a bit boogie as well, because the piano's doing that thing a bit like that chap we had with his number one.
It's got it's like the Floyd Kramer sort of.
Yeah, and therefore you've got really solid rhythm section behind it. Yeah, it's got a nice little joint, and he's singing it. I haven't mentioned much about his singing, but he is singing a bit cheeky chappy, a bit Anthony Newley, but also he's doing a little this now and again, isn't he?
Yeah.
Everything you're in the way with this kind of thing. But then he is saying, I ask ya. So yeah, 56 for music. Then production. It's another one where I feel the vocal is just a bit much again over the music. You can see why. He's giving it a lot of sass in his kind of performance, and that makes the song. But a little less would have been good. It gets a bit washy in places. There's a cymbal and backing vocals, and there's some high string riffy bits that are a bit harsh. There's a bit where the strings come in and it's like another cymbal has been layered onto it and it all goes a bit washy.
Mm.
And the balance between when the vocal is in and out isn't great. So you can hear the kind of, almost hear the sliders coming up between when he comes in singing and is out of it, you know. I do love the bass sound though. It's really nice.
Yeah, I think the bass is, that's my main note on production, is I think the bass and the drums are sort of pretty cool on this record. They're cooler than perhaps the record at first you wouldn't notice it, but actually they're pretty good.
It's that lovely double bass sound. I mean, that's the thing we're going to lose as we go through the 60s, even though as an electric bassist, as yourself, Paul, with an affinity for the electric bass as an instrument. You know, we're going to lose a lot of this double bassy sound, isn't it? I'm sure it is a double bass on this, isn't it?
I couldn't tell you. It could be, probably, but...
Yeah, we're going to lose that acoustic-y bass sound often. Not forever, but for a lot of things. But it's got some dynamics problems, I think. Not terrible, but it's got some dynamics problems. I've given it 39 for production, so... Yes.
Right, okay.
Lyrics, then. So, lyrics. Lyrics. So, well, maybe it was all women in the early 60s who were causing all these poor pop singers frustration and heartache. God,
terrible, terrible people, terrible.
Yeah, because here's another one, but don't worry, he's going to get his own back on it with emotional abuse. Oh, it actually doesn't read, it reads really badly off the page, doesn't it? You're going to pay me somehow, you cruelly wrecked my life, but oh, you want me now. Oh, baby, just you ask me, get down on your knees and try. I won't break till I see you cry. It's not. It actually doesn't come across.
It's terrible, isn't it? Really,
it is horrible. I don't really like it. It's like, it's another one as well.
It's like something Weezer would write.
Yeah, it's another one where someone, even though she wrecked his life, it's like "Lonesome Tonight," which has caused much confusion and debate when I was talking to Mum about this, because she was saying, because that kind of, it's almost a role reversal on the fact that she's wrecked his life, she's dumped him, she's either cheated on him or something. I don't know if it makes it that clear, but he's the one who seems to be calling the shots and how it's going to go now. Do you know what I mean? He's not going to let up till she cries and she has to get down on her knees. It's like, why would you think that? Because you've been dumped, mate. You know, you just go off and dry your eyes, mate.
I ask you, did you have to bring me down? Did you have to go to town and smash my world in two?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's fair enough to do with a breakup song, but it's the turning it back round on the kind of light, but you're going to pay.
I know, yeah. I hadn't really thought of that until I'm looking at it right now. That's not good.
We're going to make you... We talk about it with the Beatles songs. You know, most nine out of ten of them, kind of the early love songs, are all the nice side of it. And then Lennon would do an occasional kind of like Run For Your Life, Little Girl type of one, which is a bit like, ooh, doesn't, you know, it's a bit of a strange...
Well, I'm Looking Through You or something like that would come out, you know, from Macca. But I think with a lot of the ones from this period, it's people are writing what they think is the lyrics for a pop song. And they're not thinking, oh, I'm going to write about this scenario between this guy and this girl. They're just thinking, oh, what do you write for a pop song? Oh, it's like this. It's guys and girls. And they don't think anything about it. And actually, then you read it back afterwards. And it's like, because I remember some of the first songs I ever wrote, and I was writing them based off, you know, the things I'd heard. So I was sort of writing in the style of, without actually thinking of the words. I could have just been using crayons and making shapes that seem to be a song.
Just stringing.
And then someone afterwards is like, oh, what does that mean? It's like, mean? It's like, oh, no, it doesn't mean that. No, don't read that.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, you just, yeah, I'm only just judging them on what they kind of like appear like when you read them out to yourself. And I don't like these ones, so I'm giving it 20 for lyrics, which gives it 38 overall.
Right, before we leave Eden Kane.
Yes.
I sent you a picture on I messaged you a picture a few days ago of a space alien.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that. And now you mention it, how did I forget about that? Yeah, what's that?
And
about?
I said, this is relevant to our next episode. And I don't think I heard back from you, so I just assumed.
I can see it. I've got the very picture in front of me. It appears to be a space alien on a telephone.
It is a space alien.
It looks a little bit like a giraffe alien or something.
He's
got a weird kind of, and he's wearing what looks like a samurai type of suit of some kind on a white telephone. What's this all about?
Eden Kane, going by his actual name of Richard Sarstedt, became an actor.
Right. So, oh, is that him?
But the main thing he's been in is Star Trek stuff.
Oh, right.
So, Star Trek.
Yeah.
I love Star Trek. So some of the things that Kane has been in are like Falcon Crest, I'd not bother about that. Dynasty, he was in quite a few episodes of that, not bother about that. Cheers, a couple of episodes of that, his background sort of artist type thing.
Okay.
Love Cheers. He was in the film Pretty Woman. Again, background artist. Background artist in Gremlins 2, The New Batch. I still love that. Columbo and the Murder of a Rock Star. I love Columbo.
Yeah.
And then it just basically becomes Star Trek all the way up. So he's in Next Generation. He's in Deep Space Nine. He's in Voyager. He's in Generations. He's in Enterprise.
What?
So... And also, he wasn't just on screen for a lot of this. He was behind the scenes as well. It's bonkers to think this. So Eden, I've got a quote here from a website. Eden had the distinction of being the only performer to be present on the set from the first day of shooting Star Trek The Next Generation to the last day of shooting Star Trek Enterprise 18 years later.
Blimey.
Which is insane.
That's mad.
Yeah, but
I can imagine being on Star Trek and just being, see that Bajoran over there? Yeah. He had a number one in 1961.
Yeah, I know, isn't it?
Did he?
Cut! Someone seems to be singing.
Well, I ask you, says the Cardassian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so he's in loads and loads and loads of Star Trek, which is great.
I hope
he's very happy and had a brilliant time. He clearly loves doing it and has just kept on doing it. So.
Excellent. Is he still going, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
But does he still appear in the new generation?
His last ones that were credited was two episodes of Enterprise.
Ah, so that, 2005. That kind of first, that the second, the I don't know what wave, maybe the second wave of Star Trek. There's a third wave now, isn't there? He's not in the kind of third wave.
Yeah, he's
wave
not
ones.
Sort of come into the Paramount years.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, there we go. I like him much more for that. Sorry, Eden, for scoring your lyrics badly, but you know, you've got to be in Star Trek for ages, so I'm sure you don't care. Shall we see if the next artist appeared weirdly in any science fiction?
I couldn't tell you whether she did or not, but
we'll find out. So finally this week we have You Don't Know, Helen Shapiro.
I would tell you if I believed that you might care someday. I'll never give this away. So stay. And you don't know how hard to bear is this one love affair.
You don't know Paul.
I know Paul. Paul me.
Yes.
I don't know Helen Shapiro.
Don't you?
No. Other than what I'm going to tell you about now.
Okay.
And what I can tell you is Helen Shapiro was born on the 28th of September, 1946. 28th of September is a good day to have a birthday. Everyone remember that and send me presents.
Oh. Has she got your birthday?
Well, yeah, except for the 1946 bit.
Yeah.
So this becomes number one on the 10th of August, 1961. It's at number one for 3 weeks, produced by good old Norrie Paramore at Columbia, composed by John Schroeder and Mike Hawker. The B-side is a song called Marvellous Lie, which is in a film called The Frightened City, which I think crops up on Talking Pictures TV sometimes. But the important thing to remember with Helen Shapiro is, as I've just stated, she was born in 1946, which makes her 14 when this song is out.
14?
14.
Blimey.
And this is her second single.
Right.
So, yeah, her first single gets to number 3.
Okay.
And then this gets to number 1.
What's she doing with a voice like this at 14?
I know, it's nuts, isn't it? So she's a young Londoner who's got this strangely deep, and the word that's used a lot is foghorn voice. So she's in a load of bands. She forms bands or sits in with bands at school and stuff like that, including one with a guy called Mark Feld, who later becomes Mark Bolan of T-Rex. But what she ends up doing is going to a school called, or going for voice training at a place called the Morris Berman School of Modern Pop Singing.
Right.
Which is a great name for a place.
Yes.
She goes there because Alma Cogan went there, and Alma Cogan was a great big, highest paid female star, I think, in the early 60s. Mm. The girl with the giggle in her voice. So this is the alma mater of Alma Cogan there. That's just a thing that I wrote down that I couldn't resist saying. And she goes to, Morris Berman School of Modern Pop Singing. I did look up some adverts for it in Disc and the Stage magazine. So, like, the earliest one I found was on the 21st of May, 1960, although it clearly existed before then. Private and class tuition, beginners encouraged, and it's in Bickenhall Mansions, Bickenhall Street, Baker Street, W1. And then the last one I could find was the Stage in 26th of November, 1964, by which point the advert has expanded to the original pop singing school. Everybody comes to Berman's for style, mic technique, beat, personality, breathing, etc. And then lists Alma Cogan, Marion Ryan, Georgia Brown, Johnny Angel, Gary Marshall, Sabrina, Jackie Collins, Anne Aubrey, Dorita E, Dorita Y, I don't know what that is, Helen Shapiro, to mention a few who have been.
Right.
And yeah, it's still in Bickenhall Mansions at that point. So clearly did a lot. And yeah, Helen Shapiro just hits like a rocket. Just got, it's nuts, really. 14.
Right. It's, you have got your kind of child stars before this, haven't you? I'm trying to think of the famous one whose name I can't think of, who did some of the annoying stuff with a squeaky little voice. And that's like proper kid kind of star rather than a teen.
Yeah. If you didn't know, though, with Helen
Shapiro.
No,
you wouldn't. That's stunning, really. That's she's 14 for that voice. You'd have no idea.
But even for an older, teenager, 20s, 30s, whatever, it's still quite a distinctive low voice.
Oh yeah,
for a female singer.
Like,
you know?
Sounds like someone who's been singing some years, and but it just goes to show that's why she was doing it, because she had a talent, obviously, that was picked up. And why, if they could manage it, you just hope that they managed it appropriately for a kind of age. Why not, get all that from that voice? If you've got it, it's great. But anyway, let's talk about this song, the music of it. Yeah, so we have more of that kind of high violin going on, which we've had a bit of this week in the intro, that is featuring heavily at the moment. But again, a nice acoustic bass sounding feel to this, moving through this kind of nice round of chords that kind of have an ascendant kind of melody going over it, and then a bit more brass backing it up in the second section where the melody modulates and develops for a bit, and then everything goes all dramatic. it's not a massively subtle song again, and it's interesting how you said the foghorn voice. So she's got a great, strong voice, hasn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just on all the way through.
It is. Really.
It's, yeah. It's just sing the song all the way through, and the music doesn't go up and down. Excuse me, dynamically, it just goes, you know, pretty much. Go, get this, do the song. Everything this week seems loud and full on, without much texture. Apart from, you know, the last three songs have all been very much, this is the song. It's just, it's a hit. It's out there. It's at this range. It's at this volume. You're getting it all the way through like that. You know, it's everything is in and layering and just getting bigger mostly rather than rise and fall. However, I love the melody of this and I can see why it was a hit. I'm not a big fan of the kind of strings, the screechy strings in this one answering her back.
Yeah, I've put Helen and a tambourine and some annoying strings.
Yeah. I'd love to hear this a little more gentle and slower and with less happening. And I wonder
there is a version I found on YouTube actually of her doing it in studio on some TV show.
Oh yeah.
And it was a different backing. Clearly it was a studio band doing it. And it was pulled back a bit more.
Yeah.
Not torch song like, but a bit more, you know, subtle, a bit more.
You could do this very
intimate feeling.
Very soul-y, couldn't you? Kind of very soulful, you could do it a bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
You could imagine for want of a better reference, but, you know, another person who was young and had a great voice, you know, an Amy Winehouse-y type of style artist doing a soul-y kind of rendering of this with a bit more space in it. But yeah. I do like the song at its core. Its kind of melody is, the melody is strong with this one. So I've given it 58 for music.
Oh, well done. Well done to you. You don't know.
You don't know. Did you say who wrote it?
I did say who wrote it. It was John Schroeder and Mike Hawker.
There we go. Production then. I kind of covered it in the music, I think. It's just that lack of subtlety again. She sings at a consistent level throughout and the instruments do join and fall away. But it just feels kind of all loud most of the time.
It's just slush.
It's
very Norrie Paramore.
Yeah, just everything on. She's got a great voice. I'd just like to hear it with the foot off the gas a little. And as a result, everything else is loud. The strings and then the echo starts to compound a little bit because of that. I think we're losing a guitar or something in there almost entirely under a tambourine. You know, there's something stringy.
You're getting emotional. I can hear your voice.
My
like
voice
going.
Is breaking. No, but I'm gonna use the F word now, Paul.
All right.
The brass is a little farty.
Oof.
Sorry about that, everybody. But sometimes it's called for.
Yeah.
But I don't mind that so much. It's just more the overall level of everything and the incessant violin.
Yeah, it does not do anything for me, this type of studio production. It's just slush and it makes it drag. It makes 2 minutes, 41 seconds feel like a lifetime.
And a good song is lost underneath it. So
I'm
38 for production.
who are we to say, given that it actually, if I just quote one. Again from one of the newspapers or Disc magazine, oh, Disc it is, 29th of July, 1961, the headline is, Shapiro's You Don't Know sells 40,000 in one day. You know, so what do we know?
I know, we don't know anything. But that's the whole point, isn't it? It's my chart. It's my chart. It's my
we don't
ears.
Know, you don't know.
I'm not marking it on my on the basis of my thriving kind of artist roster in the way that I pick them hits out. I'm just doing it on what I'd put on a mix if I was listening to it. So lyrics then. Where we got for lyrics? So we finally get to see it from the other side of the fence. From a lady singer's perspective, although I'm sure she didn't write these words.
No.
And she doesn't, you know, whoever did write these words from a lady singer's perspective, they don't sound like a cruel heartbreaker, do they? They sound timid and afraid that even showing any hint to her, the object of her affection, that she loves them, that it would just scare them off and or something. And, you know,
it's all
very kind of like, this is the... perhaps that, I imagine they're probably written by a man. Who knows? But it's
definitely.
Because it's a lady
men
singing.
I mentioned.
It's more like, oh, I can't. Oh, what if I told you and it didn't work? Oh, I'd be heartbroken. It's very much, it's a very different story, isn't it, than what we've been getting from the man side, which is all like, what, you're breaking my heart. I'll make you pay. I like the, but until then line, which reminds me of something Beatley, and I can't think what it is. But till you do, until then. It kind of links the two sections. But until... What did you say? But until then...
I'll Never Give This Away.
Yeah.
Maybe some... I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. I'll have to think about that.
I feel like there's a... But Till That Day kind of lyric from a Beatles song. It may even be from one of their covers, like World Without Love or something like that.
That wasn't a cover.
Which wasn't a cover, but they didn't
sing it. They wrote that.
Yeah.
But think on it, think on it, Gary.
I'll think on it. Someone will know what I'm on about.
This is already a very long episode. We talked about Runaway for a long time.
Yeah. We're nearly done. Yeah, but it reminds me of... this reminds me more of the kind of Beatles early romance songs, you know, which are more like this, thankfully, than they are Well, I Ask You, mostly. Although they were capable of both, like we talked about. This is the sweeter side of love songs, a bit more kind of sweet and innocent. I've given it 42 for lyrics, which gives it 46 overall. And there
I think they had a... Sorry, Gary. I think they had a bit of a problem with Helen Shapiro being a 14-year-old girl, and they had to choose the material very carefully.
Absolutely.
So they couldn't basically just give her, like, a grown-up love song straight away, even though she sort of wanted to do those sorts of things. What I will say is I haven't mentioned any Beatles connections yet, and there's quite a few with Helen Shapiro, but in the papers on the 19th of August 1961, the headline is Helen Shapiro to headline US style pop package. And it starts out, Helen Shapiro, the 14-year-old London girl who has amazed the record world by getting her second disc, You Don't Know, to top place in the charts, is to head a mammoth American-style package show, which is to tour Britain for approximately 3 months from next January. The tour is the first big project of General Artists Limited, a new agency which has been formed by well-known concert promoter and tour organiser Arthur Howes. And of course, it says that's going to start in January. What it actually does is it starts in February the following year, and part of that tour... I'm a date behind here, aren't I?
I don't know.
So she starts out doing these sorts of pop package tours, but of course it's February to March 1963 that the Beatles join a Helen Shapiro package tour.
Right.
But they she's the header of this new style of touring around the country.
Yeah.
Of like bringing loads and loads of stars together and being packaged together and moved around. And so obviously there's been shared bills before, but she's doing this huge type of thing, and that plays out for a couple of years. And clearly the second time round, we get our pals the Beatles on there. Nice.
Very good.
But we'll be talking about Helen Shapiro again, so we'll have more,
good. Right.
More to say.
Well then, that's it. Oh, did you say Arthur Howes?
Arthur Howes, yeah.
Arthur Howes. So a semi-detached then.
Right
then, so onto the chart. We have only one outside of the top 20, which is Eden Kane with Well I Ask You, which is coming at number 23. So I'll do the top 20 and we can see where the ones landed, shall I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At number 20, The Temperance Seven, You're Driving Me Crazy. At number 19, Temptation, The Everly Brothers. At number 18, Johnny Preston, Running Bear. At number 17, Cliff Richard and the Shadows, I Love You. At number 16, Good Timing, Jimmy Jones. At number 15, Helen Shapiro, You Don't Know. At number 14, Three Steps to Heaven, Eddie Cochran. At number 13, Floyd Kramer, On the Rebound. At number 12, The Marcells, Blue Moon. At number 11, Starry-Eyed, Michael Holiday. At number 10, Johnny Tillotson, Poetry in Motion. At number 9, Elvis Presley, Are You Lonesome Tonight? At number 8, It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. At number 7, Elvis Presley, Surrender. At number 6, Walk Right Back, The Everly Brothers. At number 5, Kathy's Clown, The Everly Brothers. At number 4, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. At number 3, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Shaking All Over. At number 2, Apache, The Shadows. And at number 1, Del Shannon, Runaway.
Yeah, yay. Thought that was going to happen. I am amazed that Helen Shapiro has ended up higher than Eden Kane.
Higher than Eden Kane?
Yeah.
She has.
You're mad.
Who knows? Who knows what's going on?
Don't do numbers, mate.
We've got 9 years of the 60s left to go. None of these are going to be anywhere near the top 10, I would have thought, apart from the top few, maybe. It's hard to know.
Stupid system.
It is a stupid system, but it's got us this far. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Good Beatles. Goodbye.
Bye.